Thank you. It is nice to be back in Rochester after such a long time. We lived here for 33 years and then moved up to Savage, and it's nice to come back and see faces of dear friends that we don't get to see often enough. Well, let's get started. I'd like to pray as we begin, please. Gracious Father, I pray that tonight, in my words and our reflections and in our conversations tonight, that your word would be our guide, your spirit our teacher, and your glory our supreme concern. And we pray this in the strong name of Jesus and for his sake. Amen. Tonight, I would like to throw out some ideas about the art of Christian faithfulness. And notice I'm calling it the art of Christian faithfulness. It seems to me that often the subject of Christian faithfulness or discipleship, being a disciple of Jesus, is often approached rather rationally. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's sort of a series of subjects that you study. They may be chapters in a book, they may be a series of booklets, or they may be in a class, a series of subjects. Things like how to pray, things like how to study the Bible, being involved with the local church, things like this. Now, without for a moment setting any of that aside, it's very good. I would like to suggest that there is another aspect to being a disciple, and it actually involves art. In other words, it's something we need to think about, but we also need to use our imagination if we are going to apprehend it. We need both things, our minds and our imagination, in order to understand what the potential here is. Okay? So that's where we're headed. Now, let me break it down a little bit further. In this talk, I would like to do three things. The first one is to consider the need to demonstrate the existence of God. Okay? Now, I don't know if that's a new idea to you or not, but it seems to me that there are both biblical and historical reasons why this too is part of Christian fellowship, and it is more an art than it is just a mental category. All right? So, consider the need to demonstrate the existence of God. Secondly, to realize that we live at the interface. And that's the name that I'm giving to the border between the visible and then the invisible realms of created reality. If I were to take my hand and just put it right here, this is where the supernatural is. Right here. And it's right with you too. We live at the border between the visible or natural and the invisible or the supernatural. And I'm going to suggest that because we live at the interface, we live at this border, this gives us some practical ways to move forward to demonstrate God's existence. So the third point is to identify possible portals of transcendence at the interface that we can flesh out in the ordinary and routine of our lives. The interface has portals where we occasionally catch glimpses. Even people who are not religious speak in these terms. Even scientists who are naturalists who spend the first half of their book talking about the fact that there is no God, there is nothing beyond the physical. It sneaks in to their prose when they're overwhelmed by what they discover in the natural world, and they get these hints that, oh my, maybe there's something more than we can just see and feel and study with a microscope or a telescope. So I'm suggesting that if we identify these possible portals, they may give us some way to think about demonstrating the existence of God. Okay? So let's get started, and we'll first consider the need to demonstrate the existence of God. Now, I'm going to give you two Bible verses that I find very intriguing, verses of scripture, and then something from literature, and we'll go on from there. Jesus said in Luke 6, A disciple is not above the teacher, but everyone who is fully qualified will be like the teacher. Now, isn't it interesting that he didn't say that he will just say the same things as the teacher? He said to be like the teacher. And Jesus Christ, of course, was the incarnate Son of God, and he, in his very person, demonstrated God's existence. And of course, he did so in ways as the Son of God that we can't possibly mimic or whatever. But nevertheless, there is this sense where he is telling his disciples, and thus us, saying, wait a minute, if you really want to be my disciple, you need to be like me. Like me. Second passage. This is from Acts. Now, when they saw the boldness of Peter and John got up and they healed somebody and then started to speak because a crowd gathered. Okay. When they saw the boldness of Peter and John and realized that they were uneducated and ordinary men, they were amazed and recognized them as companions of Jesus. Now, isn't that interesting, too? Notice they didn't say they were amazed and recognized that they were saying the same things approximately that Jesus always taught. Rather, they recognized something that was a little deeper. And of course, that's what discipleship means. The closest thing we have in our culture is apprenticeship. And apprenticeship can't be done through booklets alone. Certainly, you can learn painting techniques, carving techniques, electronic techniques through books and manuals and slideshows. But what you really need, if you're going to become masterful in those fields, is you need to be with a master, not only so he can teach you, because you can, or she can teach you, but because you pick up so many things that can't be reduced to writing. It's being with the master. They recognize them as companions of Jesus. And now, here's a quotation from Edith Schaeffer. This is in her book, Le Brie, and she said, she was talking about how she and Francis established Le Brie in Switzerland. And she says, we have established our purpose as this, to show forth by demonstration in our life and work the existence of God. Now, that's a very bold statement. And of course, they did it in a number of different ways. For example, they decided not to raise funds, even though that would be a normal thing for a nonprofit ministry to do. They decided not to raise funds. They decided not to be trying to be really slick with advertising, but to trust that God would bring the people of his choice to Le Brie. And for all these years since they established it, that's what's been happening. That God will plan the work and unfold it without human planning. In other words, they didn't start off with a plan of, okay, we'll have a shelter in Switzerland, and we'll have one in Southborough, Massachusetts, and we'll have one here, and we'll have one there. They didn't have that at all. Rather, they allowed it to organically unfold as God led leaders to them, needs to them, and so on. And also provided what was necessary to take the next step, and so they could go forward. Now, that was one way that they demonstrated the existence of God, and because people were living together in community, they could actually watch this happening. Money was short. So they didn't do a PR campaign. They called everybody together and say, we're going to take a day off and we're going to pray. And they did. And then people saw that funds arrived. In other words, there was a demonstration of a dependence on God that was very real, and in that setting was quite visible. And so they were demonstrating. You see? Now, what I would like to say is that this is great, but it leaves me a little bit cold because I don't have a ministry with people living in order to watch to see if the funds will come in. And nobody's going to listen to me and recognize that I was a companion of Jesus. I mean, it'd be nice, but okay, it's just, okay, it's not going to happen, okay? You get, so what do us ordinary people living ordinary lives in ordinary and routine circumstances, what might be a way? And in fact, that's the question. The question I'm really throwing out to you is, how might it be possible for ordinary followers of Jesus to demonstrate the existence of God in the ordinary and routine of our daily lives and calling? That's what I'm suggesting that we reflect on tonight. Are there some ways? Now, I don't want this to be artificial, okay? Now, I grew up, well, okay, I'm 76 this year, this month, and I grew up in fundamentalist circles where if you wanted to demonstrate that you were a Christian, you carried a large black King James Bible around, okay? And you did it very ostentatiously, okay? So if you went into a cafe, you didn't just set it down, you sort of dropped it on the table. Boom, okay? There were all sort of, but doesn't interest me. I mean, that's superficial. No, no, no. And if you say, well, you could demonstrate it by having a cross on the back of your car. I'm not impressed with that either, really. I won't go into reasons why. Though I was just recently cut off very dangerously on the freeway by somebody who had several bumper stickers proclaiming that they are Christians and a cross on the back of their car. It was sort of like, you know, really? Really? So I don't want something that's superficial. I want something that's real. And I don't want some sort of super spirituality to creep in here either. That's why I'm emphasizing the ordinary and the routine of our daily lives. Does it make sense what I'm trying to point us to? So, if that's the question for reflection for tonight, all right, then let's go on to the next part. We've considered the need to demonstrate the existence of God. Now let's realize that we live at the interface, the border between the visible and invisible realms of created reality. Now, let me explain what I mean by this. And by the way, I've taken these ideas from a man, a friend of mine called Ellis Potter, and I'll tell you about his book later at the end. But Ellis Potter, and he's the one that used the interface, that terminology first, and that's why I use it. You may have heard him speak. He's been here. Okay, so if we're going to understand the interface, the way to start is we could start with the Nicene Creed. We say the Nicene Creed every week in the church that we attend. And the Nicene Creed begins, "We believe in one God, the Father, the Almighty, maker of heaven and earth." In other words, if somebody asks me, give me a picture of reality, I would say that what there is the uncreated, which is God, only God, okay? The uncreated, and then there is the created. So God, who is uncreated, called into existence all that exists, maker of heaven and earth. So in there's both heaven and earth, all right? So that's, I believe, reality. But if we look more closely at this, what we'll see is we believe in one God, the Father, the Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, of all that is visible and invisible. So is the natural or visible realm of reality, the supernatural or invisible realm of reality, and we are at the interface, that's where we live out our lives. We live moment by moment in the created, And it's one reality. There's two realms, but they're equally real. Equally real. Now, sometimes people will say, well, the spiritual is more real than the natural. No. No. They were both called into existence by God. No. They both speak of God's glory. No. There's one reality. They're equally real. And we live at the interface. Now, in our society, there are many people who say, I don't believe in the supernatural or the invisible. All there is the natural realm. Okay. And if you're more influenced by the East, you have a tendency to say, it's just the supernatural, just the invisible, and the natural is sort of an illusion, but really, everything finally is just spiritual. And I would say, as a Christian, no. I believe created reality, and it's divided in two. Does that make sense? Now, this, I believe, is basic Christian teaching. Nothing I've said so far is actually radical, though the notion of the interface or that term may sound new. Okay? It goes all the way back to the Nicene Creed, which is back in 4th century. Okay? So, when we do this, now, I could spend the whole rest of the evening just talking about these differences and what it all involves. And occasionally, people will say to me, okay, so God is over in here, right? So if we go into the supernatural realm, the invisible realm, and we find something that's really big, really, 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 really big, and it identifies itself as a God, that would be the God of the Bible. No. Remember where God is? He's the uncreated. Is all the way around this, sustaining and holding it. If you meet a God in the invisible realm, it's probably Zeus or Jupiter or one of those, okay? Because there are supernatural or spiritual beings at work, some good, some evil. Okay, does this make sense? Now, let me show you a little picture here. In the 14th century, an artist made an engraving of the interface. It was their attempt, and it's in a book called The Cloud of Unknowing, and it shows an individual, here's the natural realm, sort of trying to peek through to see what's on the other side. Okay? Now I find this rather quaint. Partly because it's all in spheres, which is part of their worldview at the time and how they saw reality and so on. But it's an interesting little notion. Now, I actually have a piece of art on the wall of my office right to the right of me while I sit at my desk that pictures the same thing a little bit. This is a painting called Window. It's by a friend named Jody Hayes that we met when we were speaking in Nashville one time. And when we started talking, she told me that she was a artist. So I said, well, I would love to see some of your work. And so she showed me her portfolio. And when I came to this piece, I was just stunned. Because it seems to me that we have this natural world with this little portal, just giving a glimpse of something more, whatever. And so when I saw this piece, I stopped and I said, do you still have this? And she said, yes. And I said, I want to buy it from you. And so I did, and I put it up. And every day when I look at it, I'm reminded that I live at the interface somehow. Now, that speaks to me. You can look at this and not like it. That's fine. I won't be offended. I don't know if Jody will be offended, but I'm not saying everybody has to like the same stuff. You understand? Okay. To me, that speaks of something that's really good. So, we've so far talked about the need to demonstrate the existence of God and realize that we live at the interface, that's border. And now what I'd like to do is identify possible portals of transcendence at the interface that we can flesh out in the ordinary and routine of our lives. You see what, see where we're headed with all of this? Because at the interface, this is where occasionally we catch a glimpse of something that's really marvelous. Maybe you have gone to a concert and you're not even familiar with all of the works that are going to be performed. And then in the third work, in the middle of it, you find yourself weeping or just so overwhelmed that you can barely stand it. You feel like you're going to be somehow. Have you ever experienced that? It's just so marvelous. It's just so marvelous. And you get for just this brief moment, this feeling, there's more to life than we can possibly imagine. There is something so great out there. There has to be more. That's a portal at the interface, which gives a glimpse, just a glimpse, of transcendence. Okay? Because transcendence is this notion that there is something more and something greater. Now, I'm going to give you a couple of examples of where I find, okay, a glimpse of transcendence at the interface, and I hope that you can appreciate them. I'm not saying they're going to do anything for you, but it's my talk, so, okay? You may have even heard me talk about this before. I would suggest that one of the portals in the interface is found in creation. And I don't know if you've ever been out in creation and been hiking someplace and then suddenly just been overwhelmed by the beauty, the order, the intricacy. Have you ever felt that? Yeah. If you haven't, vacation in Colorado, okay? Take a walk up in the mountains. Or go camping someplace outside of any city where you can see the Milky Way as you're laying on your back at night and it's spread out above you. In creation, we find these portals that are just so amazing. Now, there's a variety of different wrens around, and you may have even heard one and seen one in your own yard. I want to talk about one in particular. And it is the plain-tailed wren from Ecuador. This is a picture of it, okay? And it turns out that a few years ago, a group of ornithologists discovered that nobody knew hardly anything about the plain-tailed wren. So they raised some money, a grant of some sort, went to Ecuador, and went out in the jungle. And then one of the first things they did is they found places where flocks of wrens came through regularly. And they set up high quality microphones in the bushes all around in order to capture their song. Okay? Now I brought a song along. Okay? Here is plain-tailed wren from Ecuador. Oh, you can't hear it, can you? You couldn't hear it, right?
Just barely.
Yeah, well, the problem is that it's playing very loudly in my hearing aids. But not because my phone is synced to my hearing aids. Yeah, it's neat for other things, but not for this. Okay, yeah. All right, so, okay, let's try it again. They're shut off now. Okay, you want to hear it one more time?
Yeah.
Now, it turns out that wrens trill, and they trill and they change notes several times a second. All right? And when they got these recordings back to their laboratory and began to study them, they discovered something that they had never seen before in the natural world. It turns out that what I just played you, I was misleading a little bit, that is not a plain-tailed wren. That is a group of plain-tailed wrens taking turns singing the exact right note several times a second. This is the song. The blue bars are males. The red are females. It turns out that one wren will start the song at a certain note, and there are certain notes that follow that, that the wrens all know, so they will then sing it. And it turns out that they have 20 to 30 combinations that they sing over a period of time. So a group of wrens come together, and when you hear this, it's a group of wrens singing the notes, and as they pointed out in their science article, it was the first time that ornithologists had discovered four-part harmony in the natural world. Want to hear it again? Now, this is just an aside, and you know, one of the things that's very interesting to me is that it took all these centuries before anybody even discovered this. Now, it could be that the indigenous people living in that part of Ecuador had picked up on this. Indigenous people are often far sharper in picking out things in their world than we give them credit for. So they may have known about it before Western scientists ever picked up on it. But it seems to me that when I read this science article, I was stunned by it. And then I went online to get a recording of it. And every once in a while, I keep it on my phone, because every once in a while, I just play it. Because to me, it reminds me, I mean, how can you hear that and not think there must be something more in created reality than just a bird learning to sing? It's not a bird. It's a whole flock of birds taking turns. Do you understand what I mean? Now, to me, that was a portal of transcendence for me. Maybe it doesn't do anything for you, but that's what I'm talking about. It's that little hint, that little glimpse. It's just a glimmer, but it suggests something so great, it seems to me. But it can be not just in creation. It can also come in art as well. This is Starry Night by Vincent van Gogh. Painted it in 1889. He died the next year. And actually, this is the scene out of his cell in the what was called at that time the insane asylum that he was in, and except that he took the bars out that would have been in the window. And this was the village across the way. And to me, when I look at that, what is he trying to do? Now, some have said, well, he was in an insane asylum. That's why he painted all this. I mean, stars don't act like that, right? The night sky doesn't look like that. Exactly right. Well, I don't know all the reasons. I'm no art historian. But I do know this, that he is capturing here something in the glory of the night sky, which seems to suggest that something great or greater is beyond. It's also very interesting that there's a village here. And in the village are a number of houses, and there are a number of windows that are lit up, suggesting a warm, secure place. There is, however, one building in this village with no light. It's the church. And of course, if you know the story of Van Gogh, he started off as a seminary student and was kicked out because he was considered unsuited and ended up being a painter instead. And I often wonder if he hasn't painted this as a reminder that even if the church stumbles, in fact, God has a witness of his own existence that if you really pay attention to, it'll blow your socks off. One more. This is a painting by a woman named Gwen John. She was born in Wales, lived in London, and went to the art school there, and then went over to Paris. She was a friend of Cezanne, knew Picasso, and all of the modernist painters of the early modernist movement. And this is a painting which she called A Corner of the Artist's Room in Paris with Open Window. Now, the thing that strikes me about this is that, number one, she painted this at the same time that Picasso is developing cubism, where everything is broken apart and where things seem harsh and divided. And by this time, she has converted to Catholicism. And she paints in a modernist fashion, and I don't want to take the time to explain that, but nevertheless, this seems alive to me. It seems like it's a room I want to be in. I want to visit. The window seems like an invitation. There's something deeply human here, even though there isn't a person. It isn't a portrait. She did a lot of portraits. But there's no portrait here, no person. But yet there is something of warmth and reality, the sun coming in, these lace curtains that are barely seen. And notice this is not hyper-realistic, and yet we know what all this is, don't we? We can sense it. So anyway, this is another way, through art, for example, that we can begin to see these little portals, which gives us a glimpse momentarily of transcendence. So, I would like to suggest to you that there are a number of portals at the interface. Now, for those of us who like Christian theology, some come by special grace, okay? Jesus, the ultimate, I mean, he walked through the portal, okay? I mean, it's complete, okay? There's the scripture, the word of Christ. Also in the sacrament, take, this is my body. Margie and I, since we moved from here, we moved from being Presbyterians to Anglicans, which is not that great of a shift, actually, that just Anglicans use more poetry. And yeah, that's true, by the way. And it turns out that we go forward to receive communion. And so we walk up and go like this and receive the bread and the cup. And I love having that motion. And every Sunday when I walk forward to receive the bread, I imagine my hands breaking the interface for just a second. As the minister says, this is Christ's body broken for you. Eat this in remembrance of him. It's that moment at the interface. But that's special grace. Okay, common grace. Creation. The heavens declare the glory of God. That's why going out in creation can produce these moments of awe where we feel something is greater than we can possibly imagine. That brief moment. Love and hospitality and community. So many people have gone to Le Brie and walked away from there not having come to faith in Christ, but being absolutely moved, stunned even, by the hospitality and the warmth, people willing to listen to one another. Art and creativity, we've talked a little bit about that. And our creativity in every realm of life. If you are a carpenter, your creativity can be a portal. If you are a musician in the medical field, whatever you're doing, there is that sense of those little glimmers as we celebrate these things in our lives, in the very ordinary and routine of our lives. Also, justice. Paul says that what the law requires is written on their hearts. And that's why so many people, well, C.S. Lewis, do you remember how he began Mere Christianity? He started off with an example of common injustice when somebody steps into line ahead of you. And you just get this feeling, that's not right. And Lewis says, how do you know? Who told you that? Well, your mother probably did, but you understand what I mean. And he says, everybody feels that. It's written on the heart. And so as people of God, as we stand for justice, as we work for justice in the ordinary parts of life, we are once again providing. Think of it as being a greeter at the interface. A greeter at the interface. And being able to say, look around. Look around. I'm trying to demonstrate the existence of God in very small ways. But all of these things can be brought in to our lives. To be people of hope in the midst of the fragmentation that's going on in American society. Hope is another portal into transcendence. So what I'm arguing for here is a very simple thing. I would argue that we need to set aside a little bit of time and reflect deeply on how we can make sure that these things are a part of our life. And if they aren't, then start somewhere and grow in it. It's, you know, it's not the end of the world, just grow in it. And as we do, as we begin to express the truth in these areas, not just in words, but in how we live, we can be praying the entire time, Lord, help my demonstration here to touch some neighbor so that they might see a little glimpse of transcendence and say, whoa, whoa. Quite frankly, Margie and I are finding this last one, hope, seems to bring up a lot of conversation. I'm surprised at how many people, including how many Christians, say something like this to me. They say, wow, I'm really worried about the future. And I just hope they'll go on to say, do you? Because I'm happy to say, no. I'm really not. And the reason is that I'm a person of hope. And if I look around and everything seems pessimistic, well, that's just how I'm seeing things. I may not see all that God is doing. And if I look around and I see that everything is very optimistic, well, that just may be my view because I'm, you know, whatever. I care who gets into the presidency, but the day before the election, Jesus Christ is king. The day after the election, Jesus Christ is king. That is where my citizenship resides. And therefore, I can be a person of hope. So I think that there are little ways that we can encourage one another and figure out how might we display demonstrate the existence of God simply in ways that we live that we know from common experience. People, when they experience it or see it, sometimes catch a glimpse of transcendence. Does that make sense? Okay.
You made the comment that some see, okay, well, in your invisible, you have God over here and the natural is over here. I guess the way I think about them is being intertwined.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there is a artistic way to express that. You shared your picture of the glimpse into, I guess I can't put it into words, but so beyond the word interface and your 2D representation, do we need something more simplistic or more complex than that to try to grapple with the idea?
Excellent comment, and you're exactly correct. I mean, when I said this is where the invisible is, it's also where the invisible is to you. So that in itself, it doesn't mean that there's a line you know, here, and the invisible is behind me, and we're all in the visible, it's much more complex than that. We're right at it all the time. I would suggest, here, let me give you, I have three things for further reading. The first is my wife's three books. It's not on this topic, but it says for further reading, not for further study on this topic. Okay, so anyway, you need to read them, and if you've already read them, buy copies to give away. Okay, this is Ellis Potter's book. It's a small format book, only about 70 pages long, and it's actually a lecture of his with questions and answers afterwards. It's called The Cloud of Knowing. He goes into this, and he points out that in Scripture, for example, often it is cloud or fire which pictures the interface. Think of the children of Israel going through the desert. There was the cloud that led them. Think of Jesus when he ascended to his Father. He walked into a cloud. I believe it was the same cloud. It was the cloud, the interface. There's also fire at times. But anyway, he goes through a biblical study of it, which is really very, very rich and encouraging. But I agree with you. This is a truth which is, on the one hand, totally rational, I believe, but it is also equally totally mystical. And that's why I said at the beginning, we have to be able to think about these things with our mind, but we also have to be open to the imagination. Remember, C.S. Lewis said, we have our minds so that we can comprehend truth, but we have the imagination so that we can apprehend what it means. And we need both in order to grasp what this truth is. Yeah?
Yeah, so when I'm thinking about circles, I was confused because I thought it was a Venn diagram.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So they're actually just overlapping, that way we can like see that there's two circles.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All that was doing is trying to remind us that there is both a visible and invisible realm. But it'd be better if they were actually on top of each other.
Right.
But then I didn't know how to show that and have it make sense, you know. So yes, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Could dreams be part of your imagination when you dream?
It can be, yeah, sure. I guess it can be, yeah.
Well, that could be a problem, too.
That can what?
That could be a portal too.
Yeah, it can be. And I've met a number of people who have experienced that. I think that some of these other things are easier to decide. Yeah, I want to be a person of hope. Yeah, I want more creativity in my life and really make the creativity so that it points to something, you know, as best I can, whatever my calling is, whatever my vocation is. It's easier to get a handle on these things than the world of dreams. And so it's not something that I think we can pursue very much. Unless your name is Daniel and then it's a little different. Yes, please.
Okay. When I look at that chart, I would probably think of the hospitality and community and also the hope as being like in those Bible verses, it's referring to like God is the basis for community. So Christian community is really flowing out of special grace. And then also hope, like in Romans, that's talking about like the hope we have in Christ. But I'm also kind of intrigued by your idea. Like, are you saying like hope in general, like a hope that a non-believer or my Muslim friend or whatever, that their hope could also be a portal or not. And then, like, if they have love and community but they aren't a believer, is that a portal as well? Like, could you maybe explain, like, because I think, like, as a Christian, like, my hope and my love and my community is flowing out of Christ. But, like, what about, like, for other people?
Yeah, that's a very good question. That's a very good question. And, yes, this division between special grace and common grace is very artificial. And you're quite right that the love of God, for example, God is love, actually is a special grace in many respects. So, yes, I wanted to divide these partly so that we could be thinking about them, because it seems to me that this is, on this side, we have some things that we might be able to say, yeah, I want to walk into these things a bit more. I want to live in them a bit more, and so on. And yeah, when St. John says God is love, he isn't just referring to love that Christians feel. So, yes, and if you've spent much time reading missionary histories, good ones, or in church history, there are plenty of times when people experience love and then find their present position to be inadequate to explain it, inadequate to sustain it, and so they begin to search. There is a little bit of that, I think, in St. Augustine's story. He was really searching, and he was searching for philosophical answers and to the big questions in life. How can there be both good and evil? What's the resolution of it? And he talks about the fact that he went to Anselm, who was a preacher at that time, a pastor, and said that he needed to, he wanted to study Christianity, and which book of the Bible would Anselm tell him to read? And he said, Isaiah. Now, that's not what I would have said. And of course, by that time, the entire New Testament is present. He sent him away with Isaiah, and he was overcome by love. He was overcome by love, and drawn by love. And so, I think that's right. And I think that there's a lot of things going on around. I think someday we're going to be very surprised at what God is doing when we didn't notice it at all. We just didn't know. Have you ever read have you ever been reading Genesis and then Lot, who is Abraham's nephew, gets captured, kidnapped, and taken away by these pagan kings, and Abraham has essentially his own army in his entourage. It's traveling through the countryside with their flocks and so on. It must have been a massive thing. Anyway, he goes off, rescues Lot, comes back, and then all of a sudden a man named Melchizedek shows up. Have you ever wondered, where did he come from? And then he's introduced to us. He's a priest of the Most High God. And he brings out, what? Bread and wine. Little metaphor there, maybe. And what was God doing in that part of Canaan to raise up a priest that turns out to be the same order that Jesus Christ eventually is? You know, it's just so mysterious, which is wonderful. And I think the same thing is probably true today, that God is at work in so many ways. And I think one of the things he uses is love. I think he uses love. Yeah, that's right. But it's very mysterious too. It's very mysterious too. Yes, please.
My question sort of shoulders with this. I'm assuming you're familiar with Francis Schaeffer's concept of the man humanishness of man?
Yeah. The humanness of humankind, I think, is the expression today.
Yes, it would be today. So compare and contrast the mannishness of man with the portals at the interface.
Yeah, I think that's a good... Because humankind, because men and women are created in the image of God, and because they are created to live in created reality, I believe that we all are sensitive to the portals because they're part of created reality.
I asked the question because if I remember what he wrote, he was saying, for example, a drug trip may seem like a spiritual thing, but it's the mannishness of men. It's meaningful, but not transcendent. Sex, there are other things you might say that they have... They suggest perhaps more meaning than they really have, because what they're really showing is not the transcendent, but the mannishness of man. So I just think it's an interesting overlap that he, I think he was saying that sometimes it's not the same. So I'm just.
Yeah, Marge and I were in college in the 60s, and so you use the notion of drugs, or you bring up the idea of drugs. I mean, I think that drugs can be a very dangerous place to experiment in life. However, I do think that there are times in which the hint that there is something more, the hint that spiritual reality might actually exist, can come in ways that we wouldn't ordinarily predict. And I think that has to do with how gracious our God is in calling a people to himself. For example, many Muslims today, particularly in Iran, that's where I know of this, are coming to faith in Christ through dreams and visions, and in particular, it's the Virgin Mary that appears to them. Now, okay, I'm a Western Christian, and that doesn't fit with. I went to seminary at Covenant Theological Presbyterian School, and that doesn't quite fit with how everything was outlined. But am I willing to believe these stories? Sure. I think God, I mean, that doesn't mean that I'm going to try to do some of these things. I mean, God used Balaam's ass, but that doesn't make him a model, you know. So it seems to me that God's use of these various things far outstrip our guesses, and that's up to God. I'm going to try to do some of these things, open our home. One of the things we have prayed for 40 years or more, Margie and I, is that our home, wherever it is, our living room, would be the safest place around, that anybody can come in and say anything, including rant about the God we believe in, and feel perfectly safe there to be able to talk about it and to raise challenges and questions. Well, that's something that we've been able to do and to learn how to do. And God's used it. So that's something I can get my hands around. Some of these other things, God uses them. Praise him. There's nothing I can do about that. Yeah, please.
Yeah, when you're talking about portals and art and you're going through the paintings, it reminded me of an experience I had when I first viewed The Woman in the Chair by Picasso.
Yeah, yeah.
And the painting kept unfolding into different things, and I kept seeing different things, and I was like, how is this happening? Like, I'm seeing the same thing, but different things keep happening.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I was like, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, and it can come in some very surprising ways, and he had brilliance in his technique. So experiencing that can just be, you know, quite amazing. Yeah, I mean I've had experiences like that in art museums, standing in front of a piece of art that even if I had the money I wouldn't buy because I wouldn't want it in my house. I think it would be a little oppressive in my living room, mm-hmm. And my wife wouldn't let it be in the bedroom. Mm-hmm. So, but yet standing there, it's just like this. What's happening? Look at this. It's just so amazing. Yeah, quite right. So that's our experience of this. And I'm just suggesting, to the extent we live out some of these things, we are acting as a greeter at the interface that perhaps will help another person have that similar glimpse of transcendence. That's all I'm saying. Yeah, please.
I want to suggest that it could be said of your common grace category, that it's sort of a job description for that greeter, and that those items are practicable in everyday normal life. So it's kind of what you started with. Put that into practice. So
yeah.
Brings it together very nice.
Yeah, I think so. One way that art really came home to me is that the year after the Berlin Wall fell, I was invited to speak in Czechoslovakia. It was a single nation at that time before it divided. And so I was there for about 10 days at this conference. And it was gathering Christians from all over these formerly closed countries into one place where we could discuss and talk and all of these things. And while I was there, I was invited into numerous flats, numerous apartments of people. And we would walk into these Marxist buildings of cheap cement blocks, which were so poorly constructed, so poorly maintained, walking up numerous steps because the elevators always were broken. We'd walk and walk and walk and walk and walk and walk, and everything was dismal and gray, and nothing was painted. It was, and then they'd open the door, and they'd walk in, and there would be 15 people in a room about this size because their flats were quite small. 15 or 20 people gathered around, art all over the walls. Mm-hmm. And it was this beauty of conversation. And it was hard to see because everybody chain smoked, but it was this conversation and hospitality and warmth. And that's how they sustained their faith. And that's how they won their neighbors during all those years of communism. Just inviting them over. And talking and befriending and listening. And, you know, in one sense it was a simple thing, but they really cared about what they put on their walls. They really cared. And they even though they didn't have much in the terms of money or so on, they could always find a few flowers to put in a little jar in the middle of the table. And it made a difference. It made a difference. So I'm not talking about something that requires money or that sort of thing. It requires faithfulness. That's what I'd say. Yeah, please.
Could you talk a little bit about in art and creativity? Well-written literature to me is something that is just for providing a glimpse of transcendence. And I know that you've had a lot of experience with like reading books with groups of people, and we're like a well-written work of fiction. You know, it can seem so real and so of the real, of the created world, and then something happens in it that is just believable, but definitely transcendent, and it just really is a chance to talk about something like that.
Yeah, I think you're right. Literature can do that. We learn these things from the Schaeffers, but we sometimes have people over and just read them a poem that really has struck us and just let the conversation go from there. read them a short story by Flannery O'Connor. That doesn't put the fear of God in you. I don't know what will. But it's so powerful. It's just amazing. You just read the story and pause, and nobody falls asleep. And good literature can do that. We've read A.A. Milne, Winnie the Pooh, out loud to groups of Mayo professionals who, and just told them, look, the literature you guys read in the medical journals is beginning to eat at your souls. Sit back and listen to this. And a good Winnie the Pooh story can sort of act as a epicac. Isn't that the... Yeah, please.
Some of the portals to the interface that I've really been thought quite a bit about is the idea of marriage and the sanctity of marriage and the sexual relationship and that aspect, because it's two becoming one, which is a very spiritual reality in terms of its concept, but it's also a very physical reality in terms of what you're entering into. And then also you get to be involved at the very beginning, the conception of creation, because you are in the creative process when you consummate marriage and conceive a child. Even if you're very passive involvement, you get to be involved at a very particular point of that creative process. And God is the creator of all life, but we get to have some semblance of connection to that. And we need to respect that for what it is. And that's one of the things that I think we've lost a lot of times is that respect for what we're involved in. Like one thing I try to encourage Christians, even when it comes to using contraceptives, is realize that you, when you get married, it's like you are choosing to, in some sense, stand in the way of God's creation process in your marriage when you make that choice. And you want to do that thinking deeply about it, not simply shallowly like the world does. You know, when you consummate the marriage, when you enter into a monogamous relationship, you are a manifestation to some extent of what God's ideal is in marriage by entering into a union that God sanctifies, that God says is special, such that it should never be broken, because it's a manifestation of what God, his relationship with the church is.
Yeah,
you know?
I quite agree. And I could have added marriage with love, hospitality, marriage, community, but I was running out of space for one thing here to list everything. But I certainly agree that there is something really positive about that, and particularly in our culture, as the idea of marriage is tending to break down. I wouldn't be as anti-contraceptive as you just sounded, because I think that there are reasons and situations where it can be and is a godly choice.
Yeah.
But I would say...
I've never stood against it, but I just encourage people to think through it and realize...
To think about it, yeah.
As opposed to
but
just
certainly,
taking a mindless approach to it.
Right. Certainly showing... And of course, it's messed up even further with all kinds of visions of toxic masculinity and imbalanced understandings of a man's place, a husband's place, and a wife's place. I mean, one of the things that I learned very early on in our marriage is that Margie had skills and gifts that I can't come close to. I just don't. And so there needs to be whole areas of our relationship and our life together that she makes the decisions in, because she's skilled in that area. I just can't do it. I mean, one minor example is the paint in rooms. What rooms should color they should be? I'm partly colorblind. And we learned very early on that Margie would come home with these samples and put that one on the wall, and this one on the wall, and this one on the wall. And I would be asked mainly to rule out one. I mean, I would be asked, which one do you like? And if I liked one, it was pretty much, okay, we won't do that. And she was right. I mean, that just did. She was right. So I think that, yeah, the whole idea of marriage and what we're showing forth there is very much a part of this, yes. Yeah, that's good. Yes, John.
Dennis, I love that medieval picture you put up of this fellow with his head stuck through to here. Yeah, I love that. You know, sticking his head through the veil of the interface. But it also raises this question that, I mean, by definition, the invisible, you know, is invisible.
Yeah.
See it, you know. So even if we could stick our head through, you know, what are we going to see? You know, it's sort of a bit absurd, but I think the grace of God is precisely that, you know, we don't have to stick our head through.
Yeah.
Because He has penetrated the veil.
Absolutely.
Through onto our side and made Him visible. That's why I love the way you had common grace there. You know, the Word made flesh, and even in written form. And I do think even in common grace, I think a lot of what we, you know, can see makes visible the supernatural, invisible realities, because those could not arise from within the natural.
Yeah.
They can only come from above.
Yeah.
And it is as God works both in creation and then in salvation, His work into the created order, leaving His mark, you know, the image of God in us, and the way we can reflect something of His beauty and hospitality. Anyway, it just strikes me that, you know, that picture both raises this quandary, but then also I think this is the great Christian solution to the interface,
mm-hmm.
that we don't have to try to penetrate it, you know, because God has broken through.
That's right. Exactly.
And He's, you know, leaves signs all over, both, you know, in history and Jesus especially, but then as you say, even in our ordinary lives, we can reflect something, you know, of His truth and beauty and goodness. And anyway, I just thought that picture there kind of, you know, can lead us into a good understanding of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I agree exactly, John. That's very well said. And I would also encourage you, as you're reading the Bible, pay attention to all the places where the interface is breached. Peter is praying on a rooftop, and suddenly a sheet is let down, and he's told, get up and have a meal. Well, I don't know, but I suspect that was a breach of the internet, okay? That God was involved there. When the angel appeared to Mary and said, you are blessed of all women. Again, it was coming through by God's grace. So yes, but supremely it's in Jesus Christ, that's right, in redemption. Yeah, I'm sorry, Margie. Oh, okay, go ahead.
I just noticed it was kind of cool. They have the wheels from Ezekiel's vision in the top corner.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think they're really trying, but, and it's really interesting that it actually, it was called the cloud of unknowing, okay? And there was a sense in which the book that this was found in actually is arguing we can't know. We can't know. And I think that's one of the reasons why Ellis called his book The Cloud of Knowing, because he said we can know because they've come through from the other side. Okay? Yeah, did you have?
I was going to say, I noticed some similarities between this and The Starry Night.
Yeah.
You notice them at all?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. They like stars.
Well, that and then that tree, right?
Mm-hmm.
And The Starry Night is, I don't know what it is. Something going up, and then even the way the clouds on the outside of the world in that last one were billowing kind of resemble somewhat in the Starry Night.
Yeah. Where is the Starry Night here? Here it is. Yeah. Yeah, cypress trees. And yeah. Yeah, very much so.
Wonder if he'd ever seen that. Van Gogh would
ever seen I don't know. Might have. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, good question. Somebody, Margie.
Yeah, I really love the idea of being a greeter at the portal. And as I've thought about it quite a lot, I feel like there often isn't, maybe we don't know even when we've reached through to someone as a greeter there. I know that in my very ordinary life, I've tried, especially in different ways, but in a very small way, doing something like really thanking somebody who's a wait staff or somebody who, today someone drew some of my blood, which is not always fun, but you know, I thanked her for the job that she did, was doing, and then we chatted for a little bit. And when I was leaving, I told her, I hope the rest of your day is good and that you don't meet any nasty patients. And,
okay.
And then she gave me percentages of nasty
Persons.
And then as I was leaving, she just said, thank you. Thank you for being so kind. And could that have been, do you have any thoughts about that we don't know?
We don't know.
We might be reaching somebody through
mm-hmm.
our.
Yeah, it's exactly right. Our job is to be faithful. It's God's job to decide what to do with our faithfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And he is under no obligation to let us know what he's chosen.
Mm-hmm.
So we might do a dozen things and think, well, that was a bust. And then someday we discover it isn't. And very once in a while, he will allow us some glimmer of it. For a while, I taught a week-long seminar at Belhaven College in Jackson, Mississippi. And it was on the Christian world and life view. And so I would go down there and I would have a group of students that signed up for this course and had a syllabus, the whole thing. And I taught this course, and one year that I did it, there was a young man in that signed up for the course, and he argued with just about everything I said. Now, I don't mind argument. I was in debate in high school, so I'll bring it on. But it's nevertheless, it did get old after a whole week. And I remember coming home and saying to Margie, you remember that? I came home and said, well, there is one student that I feel like I wasn't able to connect with at all. I tried everything, conversations, coffee together. It was just gone. And I felt badly about it, but, you know. Anyway, just a few years ago, I got a letter out of the blue. And this guy said, I don't know if you remember me, but I took your course on worldview in Belhaven. And in order to help you remember me, I was the one who argued about everything. And he said, I wanted to apologize and to tell you that I'm now a youth pastor. And my entire syllabus as a youth pastor is your syllabus from that class. And he said, I just wanted to let you know. Now, I thanked him, wrote back, but I also thanked God because I realized there was no reason that God needed to let me know that. No reason at all. He could have waited until someday in glory and, you know, after I came in to say to him, oh, there's somebody over here who wants to talk to you. And, you know, who knows? So sometimes we get a glimmer of how God uses us. Most of the time, at least for Margie and me, we feel we don't. And so you just have to be faithful. and trust God to use it. Yeah, please.
So usually, you know, what motivates us to do things is because we're getting something, you know, we work for money and stuff and we see the product of our labor. So you're saying that we're supposed to enjoy the labor without any fruit?
Oh, no, no, no. I think, I mean, God does allow us to see fruit from our faithfulness. But I would say that many times we can't know. But our, even when it seems like there is no fruit, we have to be willing to continue to be faithful, not let the discouragement get us down. My job is to be faithful to Him. It's His job to use it the way He sees fit. I mean, think of Joseph sitting in that prison all those years after being sold by his brothers into slavery. Mm-hmm. And God let him sit there for all those years. I mean, God could have just only let it be 6 months, but He didn't. And, you know, and yet we read that Joseph was so faithful in his work that the prison warden turned the entire place over to him and said, "You do it, you do better than me." So I think that we need to be willing to be faithful. I mean, Adoniram Judson was a missionary in Burma years ago. It's Myanmar today, but it was known as Burma back then. And he went there and ministered to people. He lost his wife and daughter to illness. He continued to minister and to preach and to talk and everything. And went, I think it was 15 years before a single Burmese person accepted Christ. Now that is faithfulness. That is faithfulness. Please.
I think kind of on that topic, sometimes, you know, we want to see God honoring our efforts of faithfulness and showing us the fruit, but sometimes we forget to watch and see what happens. You know, sometimes we ask for something and then we keep praying more prayers of petition and we never look and see what happens.
Yep, that's true.
In response to that prayer or in response to that faithfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I tend to forget that, and every once in a while I remind myself that I should pay attention and see what God did.
Yep.
Because I asked Him to. And, you know, I have a relationship with Him. He's right there. He's active in our world. I shouldn't just ignore what He's doing.
Yeah.
And like your example with the class that, Belmont, you know, you saw the fruit in several students. You didn't think you would see the fruit in that student, and then you got the privilege of seeing it years later. But it's not that there was no visible fruit, it's just that you didn't know whether you had impacted that student.
Yeah, and I tend to be a perfectionist. I want every student to get it. You know, that. Yeah, sad as that may be, but, you know, yeah.